ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A boy named Hamnet died at the age of 11 in the year 1596. His parents were Agnes and William Shakespeare, and a novel and now a film have been made of his brief life and the impact of his death. Hamnet is what they're called. Hello there, I'm Kate Evans, and this is a special edition of ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, recorded at last year's Sydney Writers' Festival, where I was speaking to the writer Maggie O'Farrell, whose nine novels include After You'd Gone, The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, This Must Be the Place, Hamnet, and The Marriage Portrait, and whose extraordinary memoir is I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death. I was on stage with a very full house of readers, and Maggie was online and on screen. Now, Maggie, you're in Edinburgh, but you were born in Ireland before moving as a child to England. But how much have those Irish traditions, phrases, ways of telling stories, how much did that shape you?
Oh, that's hard. I mean, I should say I've never actually lived in England. My parents seem to be terrified of setting foot in England. We moved from Ireland to Wales and then from Wales to Scotland. No, not at all. Otherwise, if my parents are watching, they'll be really upset. I think it's... And I'm sure there are people in the audience who, like me, their accent doesn't match their passport. I think if you don't grow up in the place where you were born, you do have this kind of ghost self, this sense of who you might have been had you stayed. You know, there's always that slight dislocation, I think. There's always that kind of lost twin, in a way, I think, that if you happen to have been brought up in the country where you're not from, if you see what I mean. So it has been hugely influential to me. And especially, I don't know if I need to explain to you guys, I probably don't, what it was like being Irish and having an Irish passport, having an Irish name in Britain in the 1970s. It was not the easiest. 70s and 80s, you know, the relationships between Ireland and Britain were a real all-time low. And my sisters and I used to get a lot of flack at school. A lot of, you know, the kind of benign end would be lots of Irish jokes, Irish people are stupid, ha ha. And at the other end, I had teachers asking me if my dad was in the IRA, for example, which is a hard and a weird question when you're, I don't know, 10 years old. But it has, and mainly because of my parents, really. And we used to go back to Ireland every summer, and my dad would only ever read Irish myths to us. We used to beg him to read, I don't know, Pippi Longstocking or The Secret Garden or Enid Blyton or something like that, but he refused, so he would only read Irish myths, which at the time was a bit annoying, you know, because we wanted to hear these other stories. But now I'm actually quite grateful for it, because I think those myths and those stories have really formed a kind of bedrock for me narratively as well as imaginatively. You know, in myth, Ireland is a land where the actual landscape is alive. You know, a tree might speak, or a brook or a pool contains a spirit. And it's a very, very different and alternative universe to the one in which we lived. So, it's hard to quantify, but it's also hard to get away from.
Maggie, in your memoir, you describe your early childhood self as a bolter, running her own race, tearing off, resisting rules, which makes it sound like you were a very exterior kid. But how much did you also live inside your head?
A bit of both. I mean, I think, you know, as anyone who's in their 50s like I am, our childhoods were so different from, you know, those of children today. We did spend most of the time outdoors. And, you know, we used to just kind of go out at breakfast time and then maybe be back, maybe pop back for lunch, maybe pop back for dinner. You know, it's so different. So we did have that that idea of roaming. We could just roam around. You'd call on your friend, or you'd just go down into the street and see who's around. And that was just the way things were. That's the way life was then. But, of course, it's very different now, not only because of cars, but because of screens and social pressures, et cetera, et cetera. But I was always a huge reader. I always really, really loved books. And I don't really remember a time when I didn't have the urge to write things down. I don't know where it came from, because my family isn't particularly literary at all, but I just remember having the urge. I've always spent all my pocket money on stationery. And I still do, actually. I collect vintage fountain pens. I probably the biggest thing was that when I was 8, I was very ill. And I spent about a year to 2 years in bed. And I think that was when my identity as a reader really crystallised. You know, that's when I really... Because there wasn't, you know, I don't know what it was like in Australia, but in Britain, there were no children's TV programmes until I think there was about half an hour to an hour of kids' TV, maybe about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So there was nothing else to do, really. So I just read. That was all I did. And when I couldn't physically hold a book, I listened to audio tapes that a neighbour lent us.
And that is one of those terrible but also formative stories that we hear often about. Well, I don't know whether often's the right word, but that we have heard about great writers, you know, moments of being an invalid, of being unwell, of being locked inside a room or a hospital room. So you describe it as a before and after moment for you, that kid who ran away all the time. You couldn't do that anymore.
No, I mean, I think anyone, and I'm sure there are lots of people in this room who have been through a really severe illness. And everybody who has been through it or has watched a loved one go through it knows that it is completely life-changing. You are a different person when you come out the other side. It's like walking through a fire. You know, you are essentially, your molecules are all the same, but they're rearranged. They are rejigged somehow. You do come outside a different, you're the same person, but different. You're much wiser and you're much sadder and you know where the brink is. You've got that sense and you can never forget that. You can never forget that there was that possibility that your life could have ended. Yeah, so you are different, I think. And I think if it happens as a child, certainly you don't really absorb it at the time. You just walk on through, and it's only in later in your life when it catches up with you. I mean, it's hard, you know, for instance, because I was 8 when I was really ill. And I don't have a hugely clear sense of what I was like before then. You know, so things like now, I mean, I have terrible coordination and I don't know my left from my right, and I can't read out a number in sequence, but I don't really know whether or not that's the neurological damage I had or whether I was a little bit clumsy. I can't really remember.
There's a lovely description of the character Hamnet, the boy, 11 years old. He has a tendency to slip the bounds of the real, tangible world around him and enter another place. Was this you?
Isn't it all children? I think maybe all children do that. I mean, you know, I think nowadays there's much more of an awareness about people who do, as you know, slip the bounds of consciousness like that. But I think, you know, we were always told off in school, we've got to pay attention, sit up straight, you know, listen to the teacher. But I think, yeah, I think, I mean, and Hamnet is actually written from, I think, observing my own children, particularly my son, I have to say. Hamnet is very like my son. And I knew that he would be, in a sense, which is why I put off writing the book for so long, because I couldn't start writing Hamnet until my own son was well past the age of 11, which was the age at which Hamnet Shakespeare died. So there is quite a lot of my son in him, and my son does do that. In fact, I've just 20 minutes ago waved him off. He's going off backpacking for 3 months. I've literally just waved him off now. And he's 20, almost 22 now. He isn't about 12 or 13, I should stress, sending him backpacking. I like the children to be independent. I think there is that sense. So Hamnet is very much... the novel is very much written from the point of view of observing my own children, because I have a boy and two girls, like the Shakespeare's did, by coincidence. There is quite a lot of my children in the Shakespeare children in that novel. Excuse me, I've got a horrible Scottish cold.
I want to hold off going into more detail about your novel Hamnet for just a moment, because one of the things that I'm really interested in is the way in which you write both interiors and exteriors. So there's the prowling tigers and the proud after girls in the marriage portrait, the characters hinted at by empty gloves and empty rooms in Hamnet. But in your memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am, every chapter is defined by a body part. Can you explain that?
Well, when I always thought, I probably should say that I never thought I would write a memoir. I thought it was the last thing I would do. In fact, my husband used to joke about it. He'd say things like, you know, you're as likely to do that as you are to write a memoir. I think because he's always said I'm the most secretive person he knows. So we both work from home, and sometimes I'll say to him, I'm going out. And he'll say, where are you going? And I'll just say, I'm just going out. I mean, I'm probably just going to the post office. You know, it's not as if I'm having a wild affair with someone or anything like that. I'm just going, you know, buy some apples. But I just don't like to tell him. So he said, when I said to him, I think I might write a memoir, he said, well, that's going to be really short. What are you willing to tell people? So, and actually I've always felt really wedded to fiction. You know, I always felt very much like a novelist. I like making things up. And I also really like the mask you can assume in fiction. You know, in any novel, I think there are always submerged autobiography. And I think that's definitely true of my books. I suspect it's true of all books, actually. I think you can bury and you can hide really stark truths about yourself in fiction. And only those who know you really well could possibly spot them, maybe not even then. There is a character in one of my novels who's very clearly based on someone, which I'm not going to tell you who it is, and they read the book and had no idea. They said, oh, that person's terrible. And I thought, oh, really? Interesting. So, I never thought I'd write a memoir. But actually what happened was I finished writing a book I wrote called This Must Be the Place. And I thought then I was going to start Hamnet, but I was doing lots of research and reading and I wasn't quite ready to do it. And actually what was happening was that in the back of the notebook, I was started writing these longer pieces about times in which I'd nearly died. And, you know, I've always felt in a way that it isn't me who chooses the books choose me. There's a kind of other way roundness to it, and you have to leave those kind of decisions up, I think, to the sort of instinctive part of your head. It's always important to, particularly when you're between books, to really listen to what your instincts are telling you and listen to which book it is that is calling your name the loudest, which one is tugging on your sleeve most insistently. And I really thought I was going to write Hamnet next, but actually what happened was that I found that I was writing this other book, which was a memoir, and I was horrified, absolutely horrified. I thought, I don't want to do this. You know, I don't want to write a memoir. This is the last thing I want to do. And yet, I think it's really important. I think the best book you're always going to write is the one you can't not write. It's the one that you can't avoid. And so I decided to kind of listen and tune into this. And I phoned up my agent and my editor, and I said, there's this odd thing that's happening. I think I might be writing a memoir. And They read some of it and they liked it. They were very encouraging and they wanted to give me a contract for it. And I didn't want to take it because I said, I don't know if I'm going to finish it. And I don't know if when I finish it, I'm going to want to publish it. And so they said, well, you have to take some money for it because it doesn't make the contract legal. So I took £1. I should say, in full disclosure, they have paid me in full now. But at the time, I only wanted £1 because I wasn't sure if I could do it. But I think, sorry, this is a very long rambling answer to your question. But I think the thing that always worried me about writing memoir is not only because it's exposing about yourself, but also it's a real tax or exposure on the people in your life, you know, people who actually don't necessarily want to be written about in a book. But coming up with the structure of the body parts, that was the question. Sorry, very long rambling answer.
I'm loving it.
Coming up with the idea of arranging it by body part rather than chronology was very liberating for me in the writing of it. Because actually, if you... You know, I don't really like chronology as a narrative force. I find it a bit confining. And I don't really think that's how our brains operate and our sense of narrative operates. You know, if you listen to somebody on the bus and their friend says to them, well, what did you do yesterday? Nobody in the world will ever start with this kind of chronological dull, well, I got up and then I had a shower and then I got dressed and then I had breakfast. They'll start, bam, with the most interesting thing. They'll say, oh my God, you'll never guess what happened to me when I was at the water cooler at 11 a.m. And they'll start with that. And maybe, I mean, they might go back and talk about their breakfast, hopefully not. But I think our kind of natural human narrative instinct is to not be chronological, not be, you know, stick very, very in an organised fashion to that sequential arrangement. So I don't know, I mean, if anyone who's ever read any of my books, they'll probably realise that I don't really love chronology. But particularly with a memoir, it can be tricky. But I thought in terms of body part, it leaves you with a lot of leeway to skip things. So there's quite a lot in the memoir that isn't there, obviously. And you can, if it's not chronological and you're talking about body rather than time, you can leave out 5 years if you want to. You can skip over people's identities. The only person who's got their name, her real name in the book, is my husband. Everybody else is either unnamed or has a pseudonym. And you couldn't do that if you were writing chronologically. You couldn't, people would say, think, well, readers would quite rightly think, well, what are her sisters called? Why does she not give them a name? But if you're writing like that with the structure that I came up with, it is possible, I think, I hope.
Well, it's such a lovely structure, but I guess you had lots of choices to make about how you did it. I mean, you might have done it spatially, or you might have done it in terms of architecture or landscape. And so there just seems something very fresh about using, you know, having a chapter that you've called lungs, another one that's, you know, another part of your body. It's just such a lovely structure.
Well, I just thought the near-death experience is a really interesting lens through which to view a life. And I think we've all had them, you know, some more than others, obviously, and others more serious. But I think it is something that universally brings us together, you know, even if it's just, even if somebody has maybe only just had a, you know, a near miss of nearly stepping off a pavement and being hit by a bus. There is that moment where, you know, those moments really stay with us, I think. And because we are forced at that moment to really think about what we might have lost, you know, or what it is we need to stay for. And I think it just seemed to me that it was a really interesting way into a life, you know, just to look at those moments, and you can expand the kind of autobiography around those moments.
Maggie O'Farrell, novelist and memoirist, speaking to me, Kate Evans, at the Sydney Writers Festival. This is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. And so I was very intrigued that you revealed that at one point you were going to pursue academic work on the poet who wrote Gawain and the Green Knight. Is this an obsession that we might imagine or see traces of in your fiction? I mean, are you still interested in that poet, whoever she might have been?
I am. I mean, I still love the poem. I really do. And I do read it occasionally. I reread it occasionally, once every couple of years, I think. It blows my mind whenever I read it to think this was written so long ago and these people are so distant from us, but actually incredibly similar. And yeah, I did. I mean, I don't know. I don't think I would have been a very good academic. I think I would have been really bad, actually. I think I'm much too restless. But I think I just loved reading, and I loved reading and talking about books and writing about books. And it just seemed to me that that was the, and I'd really loved doing my degree, and I'd loved all, you know, I did a degree in literature, and I thought, well, I'll just carry on doing this. But yeah, I did really badly in my final exams, which was a bit, at the time, felt like the worst thing that had ever happened to me. Because I had this kind of future mapped out that I was going to do this PhD and then hopefully I was going to teach literature at university somewhere. And I felt like my whole kind of identity and my whole future had suddenly just been pulled away from me. But now I look back and I think it's actually a very good thing. I don't know if I would have, I mean, maybe I would have written fiction anyway. I probably would have done, actually, but who knows? It's one of those weird moments in life, which I think we all have, where, you know, you think you're on one road and suddenly you've taken a right angle.
Well, and you took that path and you've, I think it's 25 years this year or 20 years this year since you published your first book. But let's talk about Hamnet. I mean, an almost famous name, but an unknown character. So why that story?
Well, it was a book that I wanted to write for a really long time, as I said, but there were lots of spanners that kept being thrown in my works, one of which, of course, was my own son, that I didn't want to write it till he was past the age that little Hamnet Shakespeare had died. And I'd first heard about the existence of Hamnet when I was a pupil at school when I was about 16, and we were studying the play Hamlet for my exams. And I had a really brilliant English teacher at high school who was very kind of quite lugubrious, very sort of low-key, but he managed, I don't know, in his classes I managed to kind of get that feeling that the people that behind these texts that were hundreds of years old, there was actually a real person with intent who had put this thing together because he or she had something to say to us. And even though we lived 400 years past, you know, in the future from this person, we could still hear their message. We could still touch them, touch their hand in a sense. And that was something that really came to me in his classes in particular. But he also mentioned one day, and I should say, I really loved the play Hamlet. It really got under my skin, particularly the character of Hamlet, who I think does appeal to a certain type of teenager, perhaps one that wears a lot of black and maybe hang that a little bit in graveyards, which I definitely was. A lot of eyeliner. In fact, I could see a photograph of myself at 15, which my husband has on the wall. Yeah, I must have single-handedly kept the coal eyeliner industry alive. So I really loved Hamlet. And my teacher one day in passing just mentioned that Shakespeare had had a son who had been called Hamnet and that he died aged 11 and that Shakespeare had gone on to write the play for almost 3 or 4 or 5 years later. No one really knows. And I was really shocked by that piece of information. I think now, looking back on it, I think it's because, you know, Shakespeare, I mean, it seems even ridiculous to say that he's sort of gone beyond being a human, hasn't he? He's kind of an icon. He's a legend. He's actually an adjective, isn't he? He's sort of part of our actual, the very language that we're speaking in right now. But actually just, I think at that moment, the idea that he called this play and this ghost and this young prince after his dead son, I think, for me, anyway, as a 16-year-old, he briefly became visible as a human, you know, as a grieving father. And it just kind of stuck in my mind. I have a really strong memory of looking down at the cover of my school issue, Hamlet, and putting my finger over the L and taking it off again, thinking, well, it's the same name. You know, what does that mean? And I think, you know, I went to university and I studied literature, as I said, and it was always weird. It was never really part of the conversation. Nobody really knew. And I was really amazed that nobody else really seemed to know or care if they did know that there had been this boy, this precursor to the Prince of Denmark. And it wasn't part of our education or something that we should have been discussing. And it always made me really sad. I always thought, this poor child, you know, we know, everybody knows his name, almost his name. And I should say that in parish records, the names were completely interchangeable. Spelling was a lot less stable in the 16th century. Shakespeare himself, we've got 6 examples of his signature, and in every single one he spells Shakespeare differently. So it wasn't, you know, stable, absolute spelling was not a thing then. So it is the same name. And it used to make me really sad. I thought, why does nobody know about this? It feels so significant. It's not nothing to call a play and a ghost and a prince after your dead son. And what does that mean? So I just, in the whole engine behind me writing the book, I wanted more people to know about him. I wanted people to look at him, and I wanted to say to people, you know, this child was significant. He was loved. You know, without him, we wouldn't have Hamlet, and we probably wouldn't have Twelfth Night. So I just, that was the purpose. But it took me a long time to get round to it. I had the idea. I think I found it recently in a notebook in about 2012 or 2013 or something like that, maybe even before then. And I've got a notebook where I write ideas for books or stories or titles or even just lines sometimes. And I had obviously gone back to it at some point and drawn a square brackets around it as if to say, that's quite a good idea, I should go back to that. But I was really nervous about it, you know, because I thought, my God, who writes novels about Shakespeare? That's a mad idea. You know, why would anyone do that? And I gradually kind of amassed more and more books about Shakespeare, and I read lots of biographies about him. And between every book, I'd think, oh, should I have another go? And then I'd think, oh, no, I can't. And I'd write something else. But actually, it was those biographies and that scholarship around Shakespeare and around his life that really made me want to write it. Because if you read, you know, biographies of Shakespeare can be really chunky 500-600-page books. And they're, I mean, I should say before I'm about to criticise them, they are incredible works of scholarship and detective work. You know, Shakespeare is, you know, we have, on the one hand, we have his enormous weight of his work, but on the other hand, there's actually quite scant details about his life. He is quite mysterious to us still, despite the worlds of the work of all these brilliant Shakespeareans. But quite a lot of these books, Hamlet is lucky if he gets maybe 1 or 2 mentions. They mention he was born, he was a twin with his twin Judith, and he had an older sister called Susanna. And then they mention that he died. And usually around his death, it's wrapped up in paragraphs about how high infant mortality was in the Elizabethan era, it was 1 in 5 children under the age of 5 who died. So it was very high. But there's also the weird implication that actually that Shakespeare wasn't really that upset. I mean, there's actually one very respected scholar who said it's hard to know how much Shakespeare would have grieved when Hamlet died. And I always found that it felt like someone had shoved a kebab stick through my chest. I just think, what are you talking about? You know, this child was 11. He was his son. He was his only son. How can you say that the man didn't grieve? You know, it seems like such a terribly presumptuous thing to this idea that because lots of children died, it was somehow less painful. You know, I refuse to believe that anywhere in the world at any time it's anything less than catastrophic to lose a child. I refuse to believe it. And I just felt I wanted to write the book to dignify this child's death, to say, of course he was loved, of course he was grieved. And actually, you only have to read the play Hamlet, even the first opening act, through the lens of this dead child to realise that the whole play is underpinned by this huge, huge surge of grief and loss. And of course, Shakespeare has changed places. The ghost, the character of the ghost, old Hamlet, who apparently was played by Shakespeare in the first production, dies a horrible death, and the son is left, and the son is grieving him and seeking the father. So it doesn't take a psychiatrist. We don't need to call Vienna to work out what Shakespeare's done there.
And so you have this character, Hamnet, and as you say, there's all this extraordinary pressure of Shakespeare scholarship and expectation and stories around Shakespeare. But what I love about what you've done with this book, with all its exuberance and its running through buildings and the sort of the energy of this boy and the story of the grief, is its restraint. The way in which it doesn't name William Shakespeare, it doesn't take us into his writing. So I wonder if you could talk about the decision to do less, to shy away from the obvious, which would be, I guess, to tell it from William Shakespeare's perspective.
Well, I feel that, I mean, I should preface this by saying that I love Shakespeare and I won't hear a word said against him, but I felt that he slightly had his moment in the sun with the whole kind of story of his life. And actually, it wasn't so much here. I think what interests me, certainly, about the story of Hamlet and talking about his life and his very short life and his death was that it's not necessarily the person in the limelight that interested me as a novelist. You know, I feel Shakespeare gave us his work, and I mean, you know, he didn't actually preserve it for us. It was his friends after his death who collated it and edited it and put it together. And, you know, there's been so much written about him and so much kind of theorizing, and, you know, there are a myriad different William Shakespeares open to interpretation from what the scant details we have. But what interested me, certainly in writing fiction, it seems to me there isn't a novel to be written about Shakespeare. There's so much about him already. But what interested me is the kind of people behind him, the people who are actually not in the limelight, the shadows, but, you know, the people who are overlooked, whose histories have been written in water. That's where the sort of source of fiction can come from. And so I wanted to write about the boy. And in researching the boy, I became so enraged about how Shakespeare's wife has been treated over the years by scholars, by historians, by writers of Oscar-winning screenplays, which shall remain nameless. I just couldn't believe it. I was so baffled by the way Shakespeare's wife, I mean, everyone refers to her as Anne Hathaway, which is very odd because for most of her life, her name was presumably Shakespeare. The way she's been treated, she's been vilified, she's been criticised, she's been minimised, she's been obscure. You know, people are trying to obscure or erase her all the time. You know, I've seen, again, very renowned scholars saying Shakespeare hated her, he never loved her, she trapped him into marriage, she was a strumpet, she was ugly, she was, you know, all this strange, strange projection onto her, actually, where there's not even a shred of evidence for any of it. I mean, the idea that she's ugly, just to take that idea, is bizarre, because there's one portrait of her, a pencil sketch, which was done 80 years after she died, but apparently it was someone who knew her said it was very true. True likeness. I think it was probably done from a miniature that which has been lost. But in it, she actually bears quite a startling resemblance to the actor Saoirse Ronan, which I think we can probably all agree is quite far from ugly. but she, you know, the idea, I mean, the thing is, there's literally no evidence for any of this. And people will always bring out the old second best bed line from Shakespeare's will. But actually, I would say to people, you know, you bring out the second best bed, I'm going to raise you and say, you know, at the end of his life, when he retired, he was 52, he retired from the stage, and he was the equivalent of a multimillionaire. He was a very, obviously quite a good playwright, but he was also a very, very good businessman. He'd been very canny with his investments and expanding his company and his plays. But at the end of his life, so he could have lived anywhere he wanted, but he chose to go back to Stratford to live with his wife. And to me, that is not the act of a man who hated his wife and regretted his marriage.
So what then were the qualities that you wanted to bring to your version of Agnès, this woman who can, you know, deal with a falcon. What else did you want to give to her?
Well, she is, one biographer describes her as the wife-shaped void, because there is very, very little known about her. There isn't actually even a record of her birth, because she was born in the countryside in a hamlet called, hamlet of a village, called Shottery, and there were no parish records at the time she was born. What we do know is that her father was a sheep farmer. He was called Richard Hathaway. He was very well-to-do. He was a yeoman, which was, so he was quite pretty wealthy, you know, and they worked hard. She had a younger brother, and then there was a gap in children, and then there were lots of younger children. So some people believe that she was the mother, who was called Joan, was not her mother, not hers and Bartholomew's mother, which is the story that I went with in the novel in the end. It's also known that she, you know, it is very sketchy that she was pregnant when they were married. She had a baby, I think 4 or 5 months later, she had Susanna. And a lot has been made of that. But actually, Germaine Greer, who wrote a brilliant book about her called Shakespeare's Wife, points out that I think Germaine Greer did the most unbelievable detective work in the parish records in Stratford, because she says that actually a third of brides went to the altar pregnant in those times, because they had a ceremony called hand fasting. So it was a kind of casual, it was like a sort of, I suppose you'd call it an engagement with benefits between families. They would say, yes, my daughter can marry your son, and they would enjoy the benefits of that arrangement, and they would get married when the woman was pregnant. That was just the way it was. So to kind of impose a modern sensibility on it is wrong to say, oh yeah, she trapped him, because actually they were probably hand-fasted. So that it just made me so cross reading about all that, that I wanted her to be a fully realised person, and actually to ask readers to open themselves to the interpretation that they did love each other. I wanted readers to forget everything they think they knew about Anne Hathaway, and I wanted them to meet Anya Shakespeare, because her father, Richard Hathaway, in his will, so Richard Hathaway died a year before she married William, and he left her a very generous dowry, and he also referred to her as my daughter Agnes, or Agnes, which to me was a kind of lightning bolt moment, because I thought, you know, have we actually been calling her by the wrong name all this time? And surely the person who would know her name the best would be her dad.
But I love this insight that we're getting into your creative process, which is fiction written out of irritation and rage. And so
rage is very useful.
Is it a similar impulse that took you into, you know, His Last Duchess and into the story of a teenage girl in The Marriage Portrait? Let me just leap in to remind you who we're talking to here on Radio National's The Bookshelf. And that's the novelist Maggie O'Farrell, whose books include Hamlet and her latest, The Marriage Portrait. So the question was, how much rage and irritation might also have led her to write that latest one too?
I don't know. I mean, maybe sometimes it's rage. I think we're often told, or people who want to write are often told, to write what you know. I've been to kind of several writing workshops, and I've heard people say that. It's a kind of one of those maxims that you get in any kind of creative writing workshop or teaching situation. But I actually really disagree with that. I think that you should always write what you don't know. Well, that's what I do anyway. What interests me, I think the idea of very tediously writing, plodding through a book about something you know everything about, it doesn't hold any interest for me whatsoever. But I often think that books start for me. I mean, I think all books are very different, you know, a bit like having children. They're all, you think you know about children, or you think you know about books, and then along comes this other one. You think, oh no, I don't know anything about, I knew about that book or that child, but now I've got to find out what this child or this book is like. So often sometimes books can be sparked by a feeling of anger, I suppose. I mean, I'm not sure whether anger was about Hamlet, but I felt frustrated that not enough people knew about him. And then I did feel quite cross about Anne Hathaway, it's true. But my last, the Marriage Portrait, I know exactly. It's really, sometimes it's very hard to pinpoint when you had the idea for a book, because it can creep up on you quite gradually. But with that one, actually, was just a total lightning strike. And I know exactly when it was, because it was February 2020.
Oh, that year.
Yeah, that year. And I was waiting outside my friend's house for my daughter to come out. My daughter was having a play date, which actually turned out to be her last play date for quite a long time, as it turns out. And I was just kind of, I'd been rereading Robert Browning's Dramatic Monologues, which I do sometimes, particularly between, when I'm between books. And I've always loved, the most famous is My Last Duchess, which is, I'm sure lots of you know it, but it's about an Italian Renaissance duke, and he is showing a visitor around his art collection. you know, showing him various sculptures. And then he pulls back a velvet curtain and shows him it's painting this very beautiful young woman. He said, this is my last duchess. I should also say the visitor is somebody, is a representative of a girl and her family who the Duke is hoping to marry. So he shows him this beautiful painting and says, this beautiful young woman was my last duchess, my previous wife. And he's saying how wonderful she was and how lovely she was. But then he said, oh, but actually she was a bit annoying. So I killed her. And he pulls back the curtain. And the line I really like is at the end when the Duke suddenly, you can hear the Duke saying, oh, actually, no, wait, I'll come down with you. And obviously the man is running away, as you would if you were about to marry your niece or daughter to the man. He mentions that he'd murdered his previous wife. So I like the visitor. He's got the right instincts. But the poem is really, I think it's shocking anyway, because it's a man talking about murdering his wife. But I think what the most shocking thing for me has always been that his tone, it's of total assurance in what he's done that was right. You know, he's completely confident in the kind of aptness of his actions. It's also very subtle. I remember reading it when I was a student, and there's one line where it says, and then all smiles, I said, I gave commands, and then all smiles stopped together. And then there's this full stop. I remember reading that for the first time and then thinking, hang on, what does that mean? And I went back and read it again, and I thought, he's killed her. Oh, my God. And it was such a shock. It was like, you know, Norman Bates' knife coming through the curtain. It was that moment of, I can't believe he did that. And I can't believe he tells people, you know, especially people he's hoping to marry into. So I just thought, I was just thinking about that poem and thinking, I wonder if these people were real, because sometimes Robert Browning did write about real people. So I looked it up, and within about a minute, I had her name, which was Lucrezia de' Medici, and realising that she was part of the very famous Medici dynasty. And then this portrait was downloading on my very rubbish old phone, and it was by Agnolo Bronzino, of this young, young girl. And she just has these large, kind of anxious-looking eyes, and she was just looking out at me at my phone, and she looks, unlike a lot of Renaissance portraits, which can look quite sort of blank and expressionless by design, she looks quite anxious, as well she might, and she looks like she has something she wants to say. She looks very intelligent. She looks like she really wants to say something. And it was a really extraordinary moment, because I just looked at her and I thought, and I knew exactly what my next book was going to be, and it was going to be her story. And I thought, it's time to pull back that curtain and let her speak. I want to hear her story.
And what did you have to find out? Like, so what did you have to research so that you could imagine your way into the drama of her story, where from the very first page she's telling us, he's going to kill me? But how do you flesh that out? What sort of detail works for the writer rather than for the historian? What do you need?
Well, you need to know an awful lot. I always think research is something that has to be approached. I mean, I'm a bit of a, my children call me a neek. I don't know if you have this word in Australia. Apparently it's a cross between a geek and a nerd. I like it. So I do. I mean, I love doing research. And if suddenly realise that I've got to research what life was like in a 16th century Florentine palazzo, I love that. It's great. And actually, you know, a bit like Hamnet, actually, and Agnes, Lucrezia is part of a very famous and something sort of family that's been written about an awful lot. She's a Medici. So her father was Cosimo de' Medici, who was the Grand Duke of Tuscany, who was quite very well-known, very successful ruler of the Tuscan province. So I'm sure lots of people know, but Italy at this point didn't actually exist as a country as it does now. It was a kind of patchwork of different states, often run by dukes, sometimes by the Catholic Church. And sometimes these regions were amicable and sometimes they really weren't. So Cosimo ran Tuscany with his wife, Eleonora, who was an incredibly accomplished woman who she was actually Spanish, but she spoke about five languages. She had no fewer than 16 children in almost as many years. The Florentines' nickname for her was La Fecundissima. Lucrezia was I think 12 of them survived. Eight of them survived infancy. Lucrezia was the fifth. She was the youngest daughter. And I think that there was a hugely, I mean, so obviously there's an awful lot written about the Medicis. And the thing about the Renaissance era in Italy, or in Florence anyway, that it's incredibly well documented visually. You know, I mean, I should say, I started writing this book in, like I said, March 2020, and I don't need to explain to you what happened then. But obviously, the first thing, if the world had been operating normally, I would have gone to Florence and looked round the palazzo where Lucrezia lived, and I would have gone to the Uffizi and looked at all the paintings. But as we know, the world was not operating normally. So it was like a sort of armchair travel. It was actually a huge boon for me in lockdown because, I mean, I love traveling. I love going to different places. But, you know, there are 100 books that you can find on Renaissance Florence. So it wasn't really a hardship to armchair travel to 16th century Florence. But Lucrezia, who I should say died at the age of 16, she's the member of the family who there's least written about. Her parents had an arranged marriage that was very normal in that social time and class. But unusually, they really loved each other and they were really faithful to each other, even more unusually. And they wrote to each other very frequently when they were apart. And there's a lot of domestic detail in these letters, which actually, a lot of which is quite recognisable to us. There's one in which Eleonora complains to Cosimo that one of the children, Giuseppe, won't practice his lute. Somebody doesn't concentrate. Someone else has grown out of her winter smock. You know, it's very familiar. And so there's a lot of mention. It's very clear that Eleonora favours the boys and that Cosimo favours Isabella. And Lucrezia hardly gets any mention. She gets two mentions, one of which is constipated, unfortunately. And the other one is that she's a daydreamer. She isn't concentrating in her lessons. And so I sort of ran with this detail that she was a daydreamer. And also, there was even worse than that she, Alfonso, her future husband, who we've already met in the poem, he was due to marry her older sister, Maria. But Maria sadly died of tuberculosis, pulmonary tuberculosis. And Lucrezia was kind of ushered in as his stand-in. She was 13 at the time. He was 27. And Eleonora luckily said, you know, I insisted that she wait until she was physically mature, which basically meant she'd got her period, which happened at 15. And then she was married off and she was sent off to Ferrara with this duke.
And yes, and that's such a dramatic moment. And again, you've got the beautiful detail even of the counting of the menstrual cloths in there.
The intimate details of lives and bodies from the past in Maggie O'Farrell's The Marriage Portrait. She was speaking to me at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival for The Bookshelf. And at this point in the discussion, questions were streaming in online from readers in the audience. So I grouped a few of them together to put to Maggie.
One person has said The Marriage Portrait is something of a counterfactual and wonders what made you decide to go down that path. And I'll add to that another question where somebody's asked more broadly about your interest in fictionalising historical stories.
Yes, I don't know about counterfactual. I think I just really wanted Lucrezia to tell her story. I felt that she had been, I felt that in her kind of parents' life in the Palazzo in Florence, she was very much marginalised. I mean, it was a big family. There were 8 of them. And one of the things that really struck me when I was writing the book in 2020, in 2021, was that Lucrezia and her siblings pretty much lived in lockdown their whole life. Relations were so fraught that between regions that her parents was too worried about the children to let them out, basically. So they lived in 2 rooms up on the upper floors of the palazzo. If they wanted exercise or fresh air, they were allowed to go out on the battlements. Her father had had so many assassination attempts on his life, Cosimo, that he never left the palazzo without wearing chainmail underneath his clothes. Now, if anyone in the audience has been to Florence in, say, July and August, I don't know how anyone could walk around wearing chainmail underneath their shirt in Florence in that weather. I was about to say, I was going to tell you what I was going to describe as my favourite assassination attempt, but I realise that makes me sound like a psychopath.
Go on. We want that, don't we?
The most interesting assassination attempt was that Cosimo used to swim in the river in Florence, the River Arno, every single morning. And he had one particular spot where he would dive in. And he went down there one day with his bodyguards, and I presume he would take off his chainmail to swim. I hope so. And he was about to dive in when his bodyguard noticed that in the mud in the River Arno, somebody had put lots and lots of swords and rapiers facing up so that if he dived in, he would have been multiply eviscerated. Anyway, I digress again. So Lucrezia, I just felt I was looking, partly because I've always loved the poem and I really loved the portrait of her. And I just thought there's a really interesting story to be told here. You know, what might have happened. And also the ending, which I'm not going to give too much away. I wanted to give her a slightly, the possibility, sorry, hair's now stuck in my glasses. I wanted to give her the possibility of perhaps a different ending. I'm going to say, in case anyone hasn't read it, wants to read it.
Well, here's a question that somebody's added that's sort of related to what you've been talking about, which is about how you deal with the gaps in the historical record, particularly given your interest in stories of women hidden from or ignored by history.
Well, I think any gaps in a narrative would be frustrating to a biographer or a scholar. But actually, to a novelist, they are an opportunity because you can step forward and fill that gap with whatever kind of fits in with the narrative you want to tell. So, for example, we don't really know whether Anne Hathaway, Agnes, grew up with her real mother or with a stepmother, and there's a kind of disparity in the record. But a novelist, you know, as a biographer, you'd have to say this is possible and also this is possible. But with a novelist, you can, if you're a novelist, you can just think, right, I'm going to go with that and just do so. So I think it's I look at gaps as an opportunity, put it that way.
Now, this is a question that has nothing to do with what we've been talking about. Alice H. says, what did Robert do while he was away in instructions for a heat wave? I need to know. And I don't know whether you feel that you can answer that, but it's a good question.
Alice, I wish I could tell you, but I can't. I think I like to treat readers, I like to give them kind of open-ended sort of ideas in a sense. I personally don't like books where everything is tied up and every little gap is filled in and every ambiguity is neatly squared away. I find that those are the books that die very quickly in my head. I shut them and I think, oh, that was good. And then I sort of forget them. They kind of drift away. But the books that live in my head are the ones where I think, God damn it, what did happen to that character? What did he mean when he said this? And so I think I have to, it's a balancing act, because obviously you don't want to leave your readers with too much ambiguity, because that would just be annoying. But you want to leave space, I think, for their own interpretations. But I'm sorry if that is frustrating.
What's your relationship to your characters? I mean, some writers speak about their characters as if they're real people or as if they visit them in the room, and others see them as tools for ideas. I mean, how do you feel about your characters? How real do they feel to you?
Well, I'm not yet labouring under the illusion that these people are real. Or, I mean, obviously, you know, when I am writing about people who were real, I think you have to treat them with a difference in a way. You've got to treat them with a certain amount of respect. So when I was writing Hamnet and The Marriage Portrait, which are based on real characters, it always held that at the forefront of my mind. And if I happened to find out something which didn't particularly fit with what I had, my own ideas, I had a kind of pact to myself that I always had to absorb that. I couldn't just pretend that I didn't know that or I hadn't found it out. Because I think there is a certain amount of respect you have to accord people, even if they've been dead for 400 years. But they are, I mean, no, I would never describe characters as a tool for ideas. Who on earth said that? I think it's funny, at the moment, this week actually, next week, I'm almost finishing a draft of a new book. And there is a weird sense, obviously, you know, something that takes you 3, maybe 4 years to write, there is a sense of relief, obviously, when you're about to finish it. But also there's a sense of grief, too, because you know you're going to have to let them go. And you've lived alongside these people, real, imaginary, for a long time. And after you finish the book, your role in it is over. You know, your say in it, your involvement in it is gone. And in a sense, the characters have a kind of meta life because they go on and readers will read them and they'll think about them like Alice H. with Robert. But your life in it is over. You know, you have to pass it on and you hand it on to your publisher and then you hand it on to your readers. So it's a sort of strange, bittersweet moment finishing a book.
And of course, as readers, we remake the book for ourselves every time that we read it. But just going back to something you said at the very beginning of this conversation about the person who you wrote, who you created as a character in your book, who didn't recognise themselves. Do you reread your books and do you find yourself surprised by elements of yourself that you didn't realise that you'd written into the book?
I don't tend to reread them. Okay, I mean, occasionally I have to for certain reasons. I don't know if there's a script coming through or if I have to, you know, occasionally I have to dip back into them for various reasons. And I think what surprises me is that even though it's a book I wrote a really long time ago when I felt like I'm an almost different person, you still remember it. You know, I can open up one of my books, even ones I wrote, you know, over 20 years ago, and I can read a line and I can suddenly, some part of my head knows what exactly what comes next and what precedes it. And also often where I wrote that line, you know, I can picture the desk or the bedsit or wherever it was that I was that I first wrote, typed out that line. And that's a really strange thing, the idea that they're all still there somewhere. But do I don't think so. I don't think there's ever a moment really where you can be writing something that perhaps is autobiographical and you don't realise it. I think it's funny, my husband's just been reading the manuscript of my new book and he sometimes writes in the margin, I know where you got that from. Or he says, is this me? ? So I think it's curious for somebody who knows you well, but I don't think I've ever done it unconsciously. Perhaps I have. It's an interesting question.
So I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to explain whatever this new project is, but it has been 25 years since your first novel was published. Do you think you've changed as a writer, or I'm wondering whether you can see preoccupations that have either remained or changed as you look at your writing over that 25 years?
I don't know. I think in some ways I'm probably the worst person to ask that question. I mean, of course I've changed. My God, I've 25 years ago. It's a long time. And I think that anniversary is very, it makes me feel simultaneously quite old, but also incredibly lucky, actually. I mean, how lucky is it to have spent quarter of a century doing a job that I love, you know, just writing stuff, the stories that I made up in my bedroom, you know, that's an incredibly fortunate thing to have happened. But I mean, it's funny, in a way, I'm probably the worst person to ask about whether or not my writing's changed or what the preoccupations are, because it's something that I really deliberately shy away from thinking about or interrogating. I think, I mean, it's part of the reason why I don't read reviews, and actually I'm not on social media. I think partly because I think the worst thing for a writer is to be too self-conscious and to be too aware of what it is you do.
There's a lot of it about.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, obviously it works for some people and I'm fine. I'm not criticising anybody, but I feel actually that I need to write my books in a complete bubble of lack of self-consciousness. I have to pretend that I'm the only person who's ever going to read them, particularly at the beginning, particularly the first draft. And it's just the way I have to do it. I think if I read a review or I read an interview or whatever it was, anything like that, that voice would get into my head, that kind of analysis. And if I was writing, I would suddenly hear at the back of my mind, oh, her concerns are this, or her themes are X, and I think that would really distract me. So I have a kind of ostrich approach to it and just bury my head in the sand and just carry on with what it is I want to do.
Well, we are delighted that you carry on with what you do, and we will keep reading you. And here at the Sydney Writers Festival, I'm Kate Evans from ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, and we've been hearing from the writer Maggie O'Farrell, whose books include Hamnet, The Marriage Portrait, I Am, I Am, I Am, and of course many more. You all know them. Please do thank her and make sure she can hear this Australian audience all the way from Edinburgh. Speaking to me in May last year, Maggie O'Farrell mentioned there that she had just finished the draft of a new book. Well, that new book is called Land, and it will be published on the 2nd of June this year, 2026. And yes, I promise we will be reading it here on the bookshelf as soon as it's released. Because that's what we do. A selection of new books reviewed every week. And this year, our first broadcast is going to happen on a new day here on Radio National, and that's 10 a.m. on Saturdays, although you'll still hear us on Fridays as well. I'm Kate Evans, and I'll be back with Cassie McCullough tomorrow. But of course, online and on the ABC Listen app, you can listen to us any old time you like. So do join us again next time on The Bookshelf for more books.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.